Good afternoon. It's Film Week on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Buckle yourself in because it's going to be a wild ride with the biggest movie release week of the year. We're going to talk about them starting with Zero Dark Thirty. Checking in this week, Claudia Puig, film critic for USA Today, Andy Klein, film critic for the Marquee section of the LA Times Community Papers, and Henry Sheehan of DearHenrySheehan.com. Catherine Bigelow, directing Zero Dark Thirty from a script by Mark Boal. It takes us on the hunt for Osama bin Laden, and Jessica Chastain leads that search. Claudia?
Well, the movie that audiences are waiting for takes place in the last half hour, and that was one of my problems, is that the 2-hour lead up to the actual raid and capture and killing of Osama bin Laden was kind of mired in procedural. Obviously it is. That's what it's about. It's about the process of these CIA operatives getting information. And of course, we've gotten a lot of attention this week because of the torture, the waterboarding,
and the three senators who've come out and said that this is inaccurate, gives a wrong impression of what's shown as a benefit of torture to get information,
and that actual waterboarding was not used to find the identity of this courier. And to me, that's one of the. I mean, that is one of the problems of the film, because you can't have it both ways. They're trying to be very, very accurate, and yet.
But the torture, I think that one of the. I liked the whole movie, and I think the key to it is that it's not really the story of the hunt for Osama bin Laden. It's a story of this one character played by Jessica Chastain and this woman's obsession with finding bin Laden.
I agree, and that's the problem with the movie. She's a cipher.
Well, she's very tight-lipped, and I think the thing about the torture is it's ineffective. It doesn't work, and I think that kind of makes the senators' complaints irrelevant. The thing is, they're trying to get this prisoner to tell them about imminent attacks by terrorists,
right.
Two of them, and he doesn't tell them that. But it's this character played by Jessica Chastain who picks up on one name, and this the main torturer, played by Jason Clarke, very well, because
really
he plays
well.
Him
He's the best
as
thing
kind
about the
of
movie.
The guy next door. Mm-hmm. But he fails, and it's just Jessica Chastain's character who picks up this one name.
And she, a cipher. I don't think we ever learn one detail about
even her
anything
last name.
About her,
no.
her last name, where she came from.
One detail we learned, and that was that she was recruited in high school.
Right?
Is anyone recruited in high school outside of Agent Cody Banks?
I forgot about him.
I'd never heard of that.
She's based on a true person.
That's what
though.
They say. Yeah. But, of course.
But it was interesting to keep her as sort of there was no identity for her outside of I'm going to get Osama bin Laden.
Right.
And then
but
added
I think that
on
was
it.
The point.
Yeah.
But it also
I'm
made you
observing.
Not really believe her very much. I mean, she had so little character to her. I felt, and I love Jessica Chastain as an actress. I think she's a really good actress, but I felt like she was so blank in this film.
I believed her, actually. I mean, I thought, when you talk about the procedural stuff, yeah, it's really interesting that you would, maybe it took all those steps to get there, but you could lose a half hour of those steps in terms of a film.
Oh, yeah. Give me one episode of Homeland any day over this movie.
Another redhead. Another shouting redhead.
At one point, she says she thinks fate has chosen her. To do this mission, and I think that says almost as much as you need to know about her. I mean, she is an obsessive personality. Bigelow likes to show people through their actions, and this woman is almost has reduced herself to pure action. And I think she's a fascinating character.
Well,
and I also do like the step by step revelations and how you only had these little splinters of evidence that you had to build a house out of, and
I really thought we could have gotten cut to the chase, except it's not a chase.
Literally.
Cut to the attack, because that stuff, once you're in, once they're going to the compound, which is, I guess, the last 40 minutes or so, half hour, 40
right.
minutes.
It's what, nearly 3-hour film?
It's two hours and 37 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah. Right.
And we felt every minute
with,
of it.
With the closing credit call.
Which was actually shorter than usual.
I really thought it was a good movie. I'm not saying it's a great
movie,
it was a good movie.
Most people agree with you. Yeah. I'm kind of in that.
I'm okay with it. I mean, it's a film that I admire more than I like.
Yes.
I think it's a good job in most ways.
It's really well directed. It's beautifully shot.
I don't think I don't think it's a second viewer for me.
What about so?
I have seen
so
it twice.
Sounds like
I have seen it twice. Yeah.
So for all of you though, it sounds like it doesn't compare to The Hurt Locker.
Not for me.
No.
Not at all.
No. This is not nearly as good.
Hurt Locker was my favorite movie of that year, but and I went in with very high expectations.
You
for
don't
this
make.
One.
I mean, unless you're Clint Eastwood, you don't make two movies like that in a row. You know, right. I mean, it's too hard, and there's a serendipity in different elements.
I just don't
together.
Think Mark Bowles' screenwriting is all that great either. I don't know.
What else did he?
Well, Hurt Locker and this. I mean, I'm just saying, in this case, I felt like the screenwriting, like, I just wanted, I really wanted more with her character. And, you know, she changed wigs a few times, but I felt like, if you're talking about her actions, I didn't feel there were many actions.
So Chastain is getting a lot of attention for this performance, mm-hmm. but it sounds like you're not seeing Claudia a Best Actress nomination fitting this performance.
I'm sure she's going to get it.
No, but I mean, you don't see it fitting the performance.
I don't. I think she's been better in some other roles. I really.
Well, I think this would then be partially compensation for... Has she been nominated at all so far?
Not to my knowledge.
No.
And she's had
terrific.
A couple of parts
of life.
The row.
Yeah, she's fantastic. Were...
See,
yeah.
I think this is like a classic Hollywood performance. Like, you could compare it to Gary Cooper or Clint Eastwood. That's the whole thing. I mean, all the comparisons would be with male actors who don't speak that much.
Which is interesting for Catherine Bigelow because she's kind of seen as a director who, you know, directs male type of movies. So I really like that aspect. That's interesting. Yeah.
Zero Dark Thirty, directed by Catherine Bigelow. Mark Bowles wrote the screenplay. Jessica Chastain stars with Jason Clarke, Joel Edgerton, and Mark Strong. It's rated R. The Impossible stars Naomi Watts and Ewan McGregor. Juan Antonio Bayona directed. Sergio G. Sanchez wrote the screenplay. Henry?
Well, this is, it's really supposed to be a tearjerker, which I think is a bit reductive, about this family of, I guess it was, family of five.
Three boys and two parents.
Yeah, and they're vacationing and the tsunami hits in 2004. And naturally, they're separated, although a mother and one of the boys stay together.
They're vacationing in Thailand.
They're
right
vacationing
on the
in Thailand, right, yeah. Not Indonesia. And it's about how they're separated and about, you know, how incredibly they get back together. That's the impossible. I'm not giving it away. I mean, that's part of the advertising of the film.
It's based on a real-life family.
Based on a real-life family. And, you know, it looks really good in terms of recreating Thailand after the devastation and the effect of the tsunami itself.
Oh,
and
my God, the tsunami itself was amazing.
Yeah.
It puts the one that Clint Eastwood did in the film that he made about the tsunami a few years back with Matt Damon.
Yeah, the three story.
Yeah, I mean, it puts that one to shame.
Really?
To me.
So?
Oh, I mean, it was amazing effects.
I think it was probably... better is a strange word because the directors were after two different different effects.
Was this CGI tsunami? Or?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
But it doesn't look CGI.
No, it's amazing. I disagree. I don't think it's meant to be a tearjerker. I think it's meant to be a story about this, the indomitability of these people that are doing their best to kind of get back to become a family unit again because they get separated. And Ewan McGregor gives a really good performance. Naomi Watts is amazing, but I think it's the little boy, Tom Holland, who is with his mother that gives a fantastic performance for a boy we've never seen, and he's probably, you know, 12.
Yeah, as good as the acting is, though, I found the movie a little detached. You know,
it was a little detached, but then so was Zero Dark Thirty.
Yeah, yes. Well, but, you know, think of the material, though. I mean, it's pretty different material. I thought they would engage more with the characters here. I mean, instead, the director takes kind of one or two steps backwards and just kind of watches them suffer. You know, the film does take the point of view of the parents in different scenes, but it's not always effectively, I thought.
So what about Watts' performance?
I think she's wonderful.
It's a very good performance, and it's probably McGregor's best performance
in years.
I think
it is. Yes. Well, he was really good last year in Beginners. Yeah, I thought he was fantastic in Beginners. And I think he's excellent in this as well. For me, this movie really worked. Not only was it a marvel technologically, I thought, but the harrowing experience of them all trying to find their way to each other. I mean, it wasn't a tearjerker experience because it was a little detached, but it was very powerful and moving, I thought.
Yeah, there's some great, I mean, as well as the family might do, there are some very sad moments in this film.
Yeah.
The movie is The Impossible, starring Naomi Watts and Ewan McGregor. Sergio Sanchez wrote it. Juan Antonio Bayona directed. It's rated PG-13. The film adaptation of the musical Les Miserables stars Hugh Jackman, Russell Crowe, Anne Hathaway, and Amanda Seyfried. Tom Hooper directed, and there are one, two, three, four credited screenwriters. It's rated PG-13. What do you think, Claudia?
It's funny that there are four credited screenwriters because it's all sung. But
yeah, it's an operetta.
Really. It really is an operetta. Yeah. I loved it. And I did not walk in thinking I would because I have seen the musical. I was not particularly a fan of the musical.
You like this better than the stage production?
I did. I liked it better than the stage production because I think it benefited by the tight close-ups. And I think Hooper's a wonderful director. He, you know, took the best of what the medium has to offer and did interesting camera techniques. And I think seeing a close-up of Fantine as she's suffering, Anne Hathaway's fantastic. Her singing is beautiful. And, you know, those things matter, whereas when you see it on a stage, it just feels, you know.
You're more distant. This really brought you into the drama.
It totally did. I loved it. I thought Hugh Jackman was great. I didn't think Russell Crowe was that great.
Well, he can't sing.
No, he can't
all.
Sing. No.
I mean, they shouldn't have cast him.
I was going to say, has everybody used their own voice to sing? As far as you can tell.
They sang on the set, which is a first. Sang on the
set. Not looped. It's
not
all
looped.
Sung.
No,
99% of it.
It's not a first.
Last Love
was...
Oh, okay, not a first. Okay, but for a big movie like this, and basically they did it with a piano, and then they put the orchestration in later, and that part of it was really impressive. I think there were some amazing voices, Eddie Redmayne, Anne Hathaway, and Hugh Jackman.
I was surprised Anne Hathaway could sing that well.
No, she was great.
I
was
surprised by Eddie Redmayne. Didn't hear her on the Oscars when she sang?
Well, I'm sorry, what?
You didn't hear her on the Oscars when she sang?
No, I avoid the Oscar show if possible. I thought the movie was visual and oral bombast. I thought the director was mostly photographing the sets, which weren't always there. There's a lot of CGI in the sets, which is common. I mean, to extend a physical set in make it larger and more intricate. I thought the reason he came down into close-ups so often was that he had no way of intellectually or creatively putting the sets and the people together in a medium space. You know, I mean, there are scenes between lovers and adversaries that would be better off with the people in the same frame. But he just seems to be caught up between this dichotomy between photographing these huge, huge sets and then coming in for intimate close-ups so that the characters and the singing could match up to the sets.
So you two really had a different experience to this, totally.
Yeah.
Well, I think to me it's such an epic story, and because it is operetta style, I think that that's why it worked. I can see what you're talking about with the bombast, but it didn't. It moved me. It didn't take it away. I just felt like this is a very sweeping story.
So two totally different views of Les Miserables. Claudia liking it better than the stage production, which of course has been a huge hit for many years, and Henry Sheehan simply endured it. Hugh Jackman, Russell Crowe, Anne Hathaway star, Tom Hooper directed, rated PG-13. Back with more, including Tarantino's latest, Django Unchained. First, Hedy Lyn Hurdy's has the news. This is Film Week on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Andy Klein, Henry Sheehan, and Claudia Puig. And we start this next segment with Django Unchained from Quentin Tarantino, wrote and directed it. Jamie Foxx, Christoph Waltz, and Leonardo DiCaprio star. It's rated R. Andy, you want to start us?
Sure. I loved this. I really like Tarantino almost always, but... this, like Inglourious Basterds, really has him going to his genre more. You know, Kill Bill covered every genre. Kind of. Here, he's going specifically to the spaghetti western and infusing it with a different kind of plot material, which is the story of the bonding of a bounty hunter and a slave who he buys and frees, Jamie Foxx and Christoph Waltz.
Who's a dentist.
Who's a dentist and a bounty hunter. And the first hour of this is absolutely hysterical. I mean, when Tarantino is being funny, he can be really,
he's hilarious,
really funny.
And so witty.
And then my only negative on it at all is once we get to Leonardo DiCaprio, I felt like the film slowed down.
The villain
yeah.
of the piece.
Yeah.
Well, there's many villains.
Yeah, but he's a true evil villain.
Yeah. Yeah. Twirling his mustache. Almost. The camera rolls.
I kind of enjoy.
Well, Samuel Jackson's doing, a villain,
too.
Oh, he's
yeah.
a villain, and he's
actually
doing the mustache.
Worst villain.
Yeah, there's a lot of villains in this.
But
yeah.
He's even worse than DiCaprio.
I love Samuel L. Jackson.
Oh, I thought Jackson was great.
Yeah.
But. You mean a worse villain?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
No, he's fantastic. Yeah. And almost unrecognizable.
Whoa, one at a time. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually thought it might have been the most layered performance from Jackson I've seen. And,
yes.
And he's done a lot of terrific work.
Not lately.
Not lately, but here it is again.
Him. Yeah. Yes.
And Don Johnson, I enjoyed when they show up at Don Johnson's plantation more than I enjoyed once they got to Leonardo's place.
Well, what? It was funnier, a lot funnier.
It was
funnier.
Very funny. And Don Johnson looked like Colonel Sanders.
Yeah.
What was up with that?
That was hilarious.
Never thought that could happen.
I think there was some movie magic there. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
This is such a great movie. And if you like Christoph Waltz in Inglourious Bastards, you will love
him. He's terrific here. It's got – he even gets away with anachronistic music at times, which really surprised me because that generally irritates me. But, you know, this is Quentin taking on –
The soundtrack also samples compositions from other spaghetti westerns.
More cozy stuff.
This is actually kind of funny, Django Unchained, for him to make this movie, because Django was a film directed by Sergio Corbucci in the 60s, starring Franco Nero as a bounty hunter who rides through the West dragging a coffin behind him. And the film was so successful that it spawned a number of official and unofficial sequels. I have an official one which is actually shown in The Harder They Come. That's the movie that Jimmy Cliff goes into a movie theater and sees that that's a Django sequel he's watching. But there are also ones where they just change the name of the main character to Django in the dubbing. And I have one of those, too. So this is actually, in its way, supposedly another movie in that
homage line.
Yeah. Sort of.
And there's a real good in-joke for people who will recognize Franco Nero. I'm not going to give it away. But people who know spaghetti westerns, watch for that scene. It really is an excellent movie. Tarantino, he's dedicated to this idea of what does violence bring you? And according to Tarantino, quite a bit.
Cartoonish.
Cartoonish, but he really likes these Manichaean setups. I mean, last time it was Americans, including a Jewish American, against the Nazis.
Well, there's a wish fulfillment. I love that whole idea. It's like, what we wish slaves could have done, what we wish the Jews could have done with the Nazis.
Yes.
I love that.
And the level of filmmaking here is extraordinarily high.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy couldn't put a wrong foot
if he wanted to. Shot where Christoph Waltz is reflected back, where they're sitting, where he takes Django.
Bob Richardson, who shot it, is sort of really great.
Used to be Oliver Stone's cinematographer.
Really did the best work for Oliver was ever going to have. And he did this and Kill Bill and, I guess, Inglourious Bastards. It really is fun and kind of cathartic. My one final question is, Christoph Waltz, they're plugging for Best Supporting Actor, which utterly baffles
star.
Me.
Yeah,
he has the bigger part than Jamie Foxx.
Well, Jamie Foxx
in terms
is on
of talking.
They make Jamie Foxx taciturn, which is a key. The Django character, the real one, always is taciturn.
So that's historically accurate. Filmically historically accurate.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you really love this film, all three
we
of
all
you.
We all loved it.
We should probably one caution, maybe self-evident, but it's very violent.
Yeah.
So
yes.
Just
and it opens Christmas Day. It's not open today, but
Christmas
Day,
which is
Tuesday.
So weird.
So take your family on the 11th.
Yeah.
Django Unchained
family.
From Quentin Tarantino, written and directed Jamie Foxx, Christoph Waltz, and Leonardo DiCaprio. The movie is rated R. Jack Reacher, an action film starring Tom Cruise as a character created by novelist Lee Child's whole series that's been popular. Christopher McQuarrie is the writer-director. It's rated PG-13. Claudia?
I was not a fan of this film. First off, I heard somewhere that or I read that in Lee Child's book, the character
is 6'5".
Is 6'5", blonde and brawny. Yes,
he looks like the guy in
not
the 5'8". Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the scary guy.
Right. So I don't know about the casting of Tom Cruise, but I just felt like he was kind of going through the motions of doing his Mission Impossible character, which is a better character, and those movies are much more interesting. I felt like this was just kind of a police procedural with some threw in a good ensemble cast.
I liked it more than that. I didn't think it was a great film, but I enjoyed it throughout. Tom Cruise is actually deliberately playing a much colder, less effusive character than he usually, you know, than his
I love him as a villain. Like in Collateral, I thought he was great. In Magnolia. Yeah.
He's not as talky as that villain was.
No. Right. I mean, here he's really, he is trying to be the character in the books, even if he can't physically. I mean, the character, just no similarity. But he's getting away a little bit from his usual hero. I mean, this was a hero who I thought had a lot more potential for maybe doing some bad, bad stuff, which you don't get with Mission Impossible or has he had a series besides that? No.
No, he hasn't done any other movies except Mission Impossible.
But
who is this guy? I've never really heard of him.
He made a continual character.
And we should talk about the elephant in the room on this film, which is it's opening now, and the first scene is, you know, a sniper picking off apparently random citizens.
Five random citizens.
Including, and the way they shoot it, there's a woman walking by with a baby. And while the previous four shootings take place on screen, the fifth one, you don't see who he shoots. So you don't know whether he killed the woman or the baby.
Paramount should have probably held this movie in the wake of Sandy Hook.
Yeah, it's just, for me, it's just a question of timing. You know, I didn't feel that one of the drawbacks of the movie helped me get through that. It's an okay movie. It's not a great movie. It doesn't make you really feel a lot. I thought it went along okay. It certainly surprised me that Christopher McQuarrie directed this well.
The last
movie he directed was Valkyrie. Way of the Gun with Benicio del Toro and Ryan Felipe, which was just absolutely horrible.
And he also did Valkyrie with Tom Cruise, which is also absolutely horrible.
Well, he wrote the screenplay, right?
I thought he directed it.
Did he?
Yeah.
It's still his best job directing here. I thought it was okay. It's kind of a run through movie.
Yeah.
I think Cruise is wasting his talents as a romantic comedian because he could be one of the outstanding ones of this era, but he seems not to want to be. He doesn't play this role all that well. The only person who really turns in a riveting performance is Werner Herzog.
I thought you were going to say Duvall.
Oh, Duvall was fun.
Werner Herzog, the director.
Yes. Playing a Russian mobster.
They introduce him off screen, and from the first two words, if you've seen Herzog's documentaries,
you know who it is. So distinctive.
Yeah. It was fun to see him in it, and I think it had a really good cast. It had Robert Duvall, Richard Jenkins, who's always good, Rosamund Pike, who doesn't get used enough.
Is this about the 10th film Richard Jenkins has been in this year?
Yes.
He's got to be one of the most in-demand actors.
And David Oyelowo, too.
He actually had the hardest job acting because he had to introduce a significant note of ambiguity in one very important scene.
That was my favorite part. He's a DA and his daughter is a public defender.
But that one scene where they talk and she tells him so much. And you're supposed to not know what he's thinking.
Jack Reacher, starring Tom Cruise, Christopher McQuarrie, wrote and directed. It's rated PG-13. Brian Singer was the director on Valkyrie.
McQuarrie was one
of the two screenwriters on that film. Jack Reacher is rated PG-13. Michael Haneke's new film, Amour, one that he wrote and directed. It's rated PG-13, French film. Henry, you want to start us on Amour?
Well, I always thought Haneke would make a better entomologist than a filmmaker because that's his attitude.
Very clinical.
Towards his characters. Let me push these insects around a maze and see what happens. Jean-Louis Trintignant and Emmanuel Riva, veteran French stars, not just actors, play an elderly couple. Well, that they would have to, wouldn't they? In which the woman becomes very sick and the husband cares for her. And that's basically what the movie is, except
the plot.
there's a little action involving Isabelle Huppert as their daughter, their married daughter, with whom they're semi-estranged, whatever. And, you know, what you have is, you know, very moving material viewed by a guy who's not particularly interested in these people people.
I think the film is way less cut and dried than just, you know,
Andy has a very interesting theory, which we can't divulge here.
It involves time manipulation.
Okay.
But of course it does.
I think it's a much odder film than the impression you just gave, and that it adds a lot of things that can be read different ways as to whether this is about a loving couple or a terrible couple.
What's about a married couple?
Yeah, a very long married couple. But it's
very
ambiguous.
Married.
But it's also about who's alive and dead? That's all I'm going to say in this movie.
It's
so
really beautifully acted.
There's stuff beneath the surface.
And ambiguity, much like in Caché, which is still my favorite of his films.
I liked White Ribbon a lot. He's a polarizing director, but I thought Emmanuel Riva and Trent Ignon were fantastic in this. They were just so wonderful, and I think this is probably going to win the foreign language Oscar.
It was the LA Film Critics Choice.
Yes,
wasn't it?
Yes,
we gave the award to a cold and manipulative film this year.
Wouldn't be the first time.
Which you wholeheartedly supported. So Claudia, I just wanted to hear just a little more from you on this. Mm-hmm. Did it work? Did those performances
for me. Yes.
Were they?
Absolutely. I'm now kind of fascinated by what Andy came up with, so I'm kind of I have to go back and watch it again.
Yeah, Andy's decoding in mind.
But no, the way I saw it, I just thought it was this couple that had been together for a very long time. You could read it as either they were very loving or that perhaps they were not. But
very
used to each other.
I'm not saying loving or hating. I'm saying very married.
Yes. Definitely. Yeah. But I just think the performances were wonderful. I thought Isabel Huppert's performance, even as small as it was good.
She's always good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Always.
It's very, a very brief. Intriguing film and very beautifully directed. It all takes place in one apartment, basically.
Yeah. Amour, the film written and directed by Michael Haneke and rated PG-13. On the Road, the Kerouac story, adapted by Jose Rivera, who wrote it. Walter Salles directed the film. It's rated R. Henry?
Well, there's a significant problem in adapting on the Road. Yeah. No, I mean, that a director would face in adapting it. And that isn't the experience part of that book. What really happens in that book is how the author's mind is blown, let's say, to use it, you know, how it's changed, how it's excited. So the director has to find a way to make that the language of the film. It has to be the internal perception of the author, of the central character, who is an I, to make the action. That is the action. And in a nutshell, Walter Salles doesn't come close to doing that.
And I love Walter Salles, but I thought Motorcycle Diaries was a really great road picture. This was not a really great road picture, and it's not. It is, I think, exactly the problem that you're stating, because it's probably something that could not be adapted.
It's also
to film.
It can't be adapted. I mean, I was really in. I mean, I went hitchhiking because of this book. You know, I mean, I went out on the road because that was a long time ago, and one of the things that's lost here is some of the book is very, very funny. I mean, his first road trip, I think, was sort of self-mockingly funny about how innocent he was. None of that comes
no
through
humor
here.
No.
And there's a real problem with taking a character based on Neil Cassady, who's already iconic, at least among people who, you know, who are interested in this stuff. And Garrett Hedlund, you know, he was okay, but he didn't have it for me in that role.
I agree.
Yeah, and I thought Sam Riley was very bad as the central character, the writer.
He wasn't so great. And Kristen Stewart, let's just not even talk about her.
I mean, yeah, she was.
She should be relegated to
really
Twilight
terrible.
And nothing else. Yeah.
Apparently, all she can do is pout and look disgusted.
That's all she ever does. Yeah.
All right, On the Road should be sent out of town, according to our critics. Walter Salles directed. Jose Rivera did the screenplay adaptation. On the Road is rated R. Barbara is about a young woman doctor, 1980 in East Germany. Nina Haas stars. Christian Petzold is the writer-director. It's rated PG-13. It's a German film. Claudia?
I really like this film, and I have to say that I saw it at a very, very late hour, and I was completely riveted by it unfolds very slowly. The character is not revealed much, and it's set in 1980?
Yeah,
in East Germany. And, you know, I realized that I did not know enough about that era and sort of the big brother-like, you know,
right.
antics.
And the fact that almost everybody was informing to the Stasi.
Right.
Enough people that you couldn't take the chance that somebody wasn't.
So you have to live your life in this very circumspect way. And this doctor, this woman is a fascinating character. I thought she was really well acted. And then this other doctor who tries to bring her out.
This friendly, this doctor had been at a prestigious hospital in Berlin for reasons that are never explicitly stated, but which are clearly political.
Right.
She's been sent to this hospital in the provinces where she works under this like really nice doctor.
Right. And it's beautiful. It's where it's shot is beautiful. And in contrast to sort of the hardness and the sort of emotional holding back, I think,
right.
of the characters.
Her reserve.
Yeah.
I think really that's what makes the movie. I don't know if I like it as much as you, but it's the fact that the character stays reserved, stays closed even to the end, I thought was fascinating.
Yes, I agree.
Don't go away. We have a lot more to talk about. We just heard about the German film Barbara, written and directed by Christian Petzold, rated PG-13. Coming up, we'll hear about Not Fade Away, The Guilt Trip, This Is 40, and much more. It's Film Week on Air Talk. Hedy Lynn Hurdies has the news. Good afternoon. It's Film Week on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Henry Sheehan, Claudia Puig, and Andy Klein. Next up is Not Fade Away. After seeing the Rolling Stones perform on TV in 1964, three friends formed their own rock band. David Chase of The Sopranos wrote and directed. James Gandolfini, John Magaro, and Will Brill star in this R-rated film. Claudia?
We should also say that Steve Van Zandt executive produced it, who also starred in The Sopranos.
Little Steven,
yes. And the soundtrack is fantastic because of it. So to me, it's all about the soundtrack. It's very nostalgic. It traces this teenager played by John Magaro, which I thought he gave a good performance. He looks a lot like Bob Dylan, actually, kind of the young Bob Dylan, of course. It's the saga of this teenager between the years of 63 and 68, very seminal years. He thinks he's going to become a rock star and then realizes he's not. But he goes to film school. So does this sound like this could be David Chase?
We all thought this.
Might be. And he's Italian-American.
Right.
And this is
and it's set in New Jersey. And James Gandolfini plays his father.
Right.
In a very different role from Tony Soprano, of course.
Right,
There's
right.
no bada bing here. But
Right. He plays the morose, working class guy.
Yeah.
I thought really what made this film, I didn't think it was a very good film.
No, not great.
Except that he was willing to follow his lead character into areas where the lead character was not a good guy, did not do good things, that deliberately, consciously looked out for himself instead of his friends. And you don't often see that in a movie. And I thought that was an unusual sign of integrity in a modern American
film. As was the
film.
Ending, which broke the fourth wall and did some interesting things, I thought.
Yeah.
I thought there was a lot of integrity in this, and I thought it was intriguing. I mean, I was a huge fan of The Sopranos, and of course it's a very different thing when you're getting to develop something, you know, over the course of time.
Yeah.
Right.
But I kind of like this. I thought there were some good performances. I thought, you know, it's nostalgic. It was a coming-of-age story. So we've kind of seen it.
Now that you mention that, you can kind of see this as like a three-part miniseries or something where he could unpack some of the baggage of the characters that he keeps locked up that would have told us more, that wouldn't have been – there's a lot of skipping, I think, in this movie at times. And that would have helped him, I think. I think, you know, maybe a 90-minute feature film is not his métier.
Yes.
But it sure can do television.
There's not much better than The Sopranos out there.
Not Fade Away is a film from The Sopranos creator, writer-director David Chase, James Gandolfini, and John Magaro star. It's rated R. The Guilt Trip pairs Barbara Streisand and Seth Rogen as mother and son on a road trip. Ann Fletcher directed, Dan Fogelman wrote it. It's rated PG-13. Henry?
Well, this is a very commercial movie. It's a very calculated movie.
You think?
It's the movie where if you're a couple in your 30s, let's say, and you're being visited by one set of parents or both, this is the movie you're supposed to go to together. There's Seth Rogen for the younger group and Barbara Streisand for the older group, and you know, they're just kind of thrown together on screen, and it's like it almost looks like the movie said, okay, sink or swim, and they mostly sink. I think Barbara Streisand, it does remind you of what a dynamic presence she is on screen, that she just can really walk out there, and it's like you watch her, and you know, you want to hear what she has to say. The problem is she doesn't really have anything to say,
and that's not
very
really her
amusing.
Problem. It's the writer, obviously.
The writer.
Yeah. I think she does the best she can with that role, and she looks amazing at 70 years old and has a lot of vibrancy still to her, of course. I thought Seth Rogen was really kind of tamped down, almost like he was in awe of being on screen with Streisand.
That mumble thing he does.
Yeah.
You know, and it's almost only that mumble thing.
But everything's predictable. And then there's just sort of almost like a rom-com where they throw up this hurdle that isn't really a hurdle, and you know, you have to surmount it in order to get to, you know, the rapprochement at the end. And it's just very predictable.
Yeah. And, you know, badly directed. I want to mention that the ads you see on television can have clips, long clips, from scenes that are not in the movie.
Right.
So beware.
How can you do that?
They do it all the time.
It's one of two movies. The next movie we're doing, This Is 40, the commercials are even worse. There's one that has, I think, clips from two scenes that aren't in the movie.
Wow.
So I don't know how they can get away with that. I think, you know, it's literally false advertising.
Yeah, and are there so many great scenes in the film that they couldn't make it, so they put it in the ad?
And the outtakes of the movie I thought were funnier than anything in the movie. If you stay through the credits. Yeah.
But also it gives away the fact that a lot of it was improvised and not written ahead of time. And, you know, I just think that's a mistake. You know, maybe the actors are not inspired that day. You have to have a script. You know, you just can't throw actors out there.
Writing is
everything.
You
need a script. Yeah. Maybe if you want to improvise off of that, okay. But, you know.
Or improvise in rehearsal and keep the best stuff.
Yeah, not everything. And here they were just shooting them, you know, and clearly they just cut out the stuff that they thought was best, which I might argue with them about, actually.
Isn't that what Mike Lee does when he gets his actors together and they do these long rehearsals?
Yeah, he does
but they have the script.
And then the script gets refined as they work together.
And they develop
it?
Their characters as they go along in that rehearsal process.
He gets them together and they improvise the lives of the characters up to the point where the movie starts.
I just want to say one thing about this movie that I thought was also very odd. They have a whole new kind of product placement. They're reading the book Middlesex by listening to it on tape.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they mentioned Jeffrey Eugenides, they mentioned Middlesex, and you hear parts of the book. And I'm like, wow, I've never heard of a book advertised in a movie. I mean, it's a great book, but it was odd.
Yeah, it's like them watching the preview of another movie.
We've spent enough time on the guilt
trip. Yes, we have.
Barbara Streisand, Seth Rogen star Dan Fogelman wrote it, and Anne Fletcher directed, rated PG-13. The comedy This Is 40, written and directed by Judd Apatow, Paul Rudd, Leslie Mann star, and it's rated R. Andy?
This alleged comedy. Mm-hmm. Basically, a couple who we did see, I guess, in Knocked Up, and this is the same
sort of
characters
sequel.
Taking
Billed
over.
Billed as a sequel, sort of.
Yeah.
But it's terrible all on its own.
Yes.
Whereas Knocked Up was good.
Up.
I like Knocked Up, too.
This was awful. They're having everything go wrong in their lives all during the course of this week when they're both having their 40th birthdays and his business is going. He's been irresponsible. The problem is that these are really kind of horrible people. Not only are they like really spoiled, you know, privileged types, but yeah, there's one scene that had some of the funniest stuff in the film in it, one of the few funny things, but where they are just they're lying to an authority figure about, oh, we didn't go and intimidate Melissa McCarthy.
Yeah, they verbally abuse a child.
And then lie about it.
Yeah. And then lie about it.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, they are not nice people, and I think it's a pretty dicey proposition to make such privileged people seem relatable anyway. I just feel like...
It's like Apatow doesn't know he's privileged. He doesn't know he's rich.
He thinks we're all this way, I think. And
And the bathroom humor. I mean, do we really need to, you know, go into detail about hemorrhoids and colonoscopies and all the other?
Yeah, and this film is about 2 hours and 15 minutes long, and there are entire subplots that could have been excised without affecting anything.
Only helping.
So this kind of reminds me of like Hangover 2, where the first film was funny and it sort of all came together.
This is actually much worse than Hangover 2.
Really?
Much worse.
How could it be?
Except for like three scenes featuring Albert Brooks, scenes which he clearly either wrote or improvised, which he dominates and which are funny. This is just one stinking pile of garbage.
The very end of Funny People, where it kind of went into that whole long thing with Leslie Mann and her kids, it kind of reminded me of that.
Leslie Mann is, I must point out, all she does is shriek and whine through this whole movie. And I think it's supposed to be cute. I think that's what Apatow thought. It's not cute.
Well, of course
it's
grating.
It's obnoxious. It's his wife. You know? And you know, Paul Rudd, you know, he started his own record label. I suppose this is supposed to be one of the relatable things, that this guy has money to start his own record label. And he's having financial problems with it. It's a vanity label. A vanity label and a vanity film.
This is 40. Henry says worse than The Hangover 2, which is just written and directed by Judd Apatow and rated R. The documentary Cirque du Soleil Worlds Away is a performance film written and directed by Andrew Adamson, rated PG. Well, I guess it is. I guess not a documentary. What would you call it?
Well, it's essentially the record of a stage performance with some additional elements that you could only have in a movie.
Okay.
I mean, as an an introductory.
To go with it. Okay.
Yeah, but they even have the proscenium arch, the curtain go up, and things like that. One of the problems with the movie is that things that have tremendous scale on stage, you know, like a huge wall going up, do not necessarily have scale on a movie unless you know how to do it. And the director here, Andrew Adamson, doesn't know how to do it. So everything is kind of condensed to like the same size because it takes up the same amount of space on screen. You know, a person and a huge wall, you know, don't really have that much difference in scale between them. It has kind of a plot, a kind of Orpheus in Hell plot, but it needs more because otherwise it just becomes a series of acrobatics, which are very impressive, but they're just one kind of slow acrobatic scene after another. And, you know, there's a certain monotony where you kind of end up sitting there thinking, wow, these people are really gifted, but, you know, I'm not really excited by it yet for the fifth time.
The movie is Cirque du Soleil, Worlds Away. Andy Adamson wrote and directed. It's rated PG. The documentary West of Memphis trots a similar ground to Paradise Lost, a series of HBO documentaries that look at the case of the West Memphis Three. Those are three men and young men and boys who were convicted in the killings of 3 8-year-old Arkansas boys. Amy Berg directed West of Memphis. Andy?
This film has the big problem of coming out after the Paradise Lost series. Three films totaling about 6 hours, which were great. I felt like this was kind of the Cliff Notes summary of those three films.
Except this one criticizes Paradise Lost.
Well,
overtly, at one point.
They do?
They say that Paradise Lost accuses another person of the murders, and they say it definitely wasn't him, and he should never have been singled out for that.
Well, he says it. I mean, I don't know that
the narrator says it.
No.
Or one of the interviewees.
I thought the character.
Yeah, they all do. The film and him do.
That aside, Paradise Lost is also more interesting because of their involvement in the case. They become part of the story. I mean, that I thought would be the virtue here, would be having some distance from that, not
because
being
Paradise
part of
Lost
the story.
Is advocacy documentary.
Yes.
Well, so is this.
But this just... If I hadn't seen Paradise Lost, I probably would have thought this was really, really good. But having seen those films, this just feels like a gloss.
All right.
I thought it was padded. It's 2.5 hours, and too much of it is about people like Eddie Vedder and Peter Jackson and Fran Walsh. Jackson and Walsh produced the movie, and about them saying what they've done for the characters and what they're the kids. I keep saying characters. Of course, these are all real people. You know, their interactions with the with Damien Eccles in particular, and with his wife Laurie, who was working the hardest to get them free. And there was too much about that. The actual parts of the movie that investigated the crime had more than Paradise Lost, some new information. For instance, this movie, I don't think Paradise Lost said, but this movie says those three kids were murdered. They were not sexually abused. You know, and they bring out six medical examiners, active and retired medical examiners, to say that. You know, I won't say exactly what it is, but they say it was like almost a rage murder of one kid, and the other two kids happened to be there.
The film is West of Memphis. Amy Berg directed, and it's rated R. I do want to talk about The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, because we, of course, were preempted last week because of the terrible events in Connecticut. And I wanted to hear what you three thought of the film, and also what you thought of the 48 frame per second 3D version. That's the version I saw of the film, and I'm just curious your take. Claudia, what'd you think?
I saw both intentionally because of that, and I saw the 48 first, and I did not really feel the hyperrealism was necessarily an asset for a fantasy film, and I think largely because this is a fantasy film, and it already looks like something we don't know. And then having said that, it looks like something we do kind of know from the Lord of the Rings movie. So you have a certain expectation, and then the hyperrealism of the 48, for me, it sort of took me out of the movie.
Took you out of the film.
It took me a while to
adjust. I thought particularly I thought it improved as it went along because the movie became dark. I mean, literally, not emotionally. But the scenes were darker. The beginning, which take place in bright light, didn't look like a movie at all. It looked like a visit to a set. Yeah. And
yes,
what it looked
totally.
Like was you were looking at actors. You were looking at Martin Campbell and Ian McKellen on a very highly polished set.
This is what 48 frames a second does. And if you've ever watched one of those HDTVs where they will interpolate frames, smooth scan, easy flow, whatever they call it, it's an optional setting, and suddenly all your movies look like
It does the same thing.
Reports.
It gives you that look of video instead of film.
Sort of,
exactly.
But this is better than that. And I have to say, to my great surprise,
it was shot on video.
Yeah,
on the Red Epic, I think.
Yeah. But to my great surprise, after 10 or 15 minutes, I wasn't bothered at all.
But did
I don't
you find
think
it more immersive? I didn't.
Yes, I did actually at times, but I still think it was the wrong film to do it.
I completely agree.
For me, it made it more distanced.
Yes.
But on the other hand, it's not a good movie.
And that first not at all. 45 minutes where the dwarves are all having, you know, their parting.
It's
awful to sit through. But I think for another movie, it would have. I mean, I really want to see something 48, but not this movie.
I mean, it should be in spectaculars at least to start with, and I don't mean this kind of spectacular, but the stuff IMAX used to do of, you know, you're on a roller coaster, you're on a train, and
you're
certain movies where it would really. Where it would make sense to have you right in the scene. In
Absolutely.
Middle Earth, you can't be right in the scene.
People have gotten this effect in the past. In 1960, Lee Garm shot and Frank Borzage directed a movie. I think it was called Shoes of the Fisherman in Super Panavision 70. And no, it wasn't Shoes of the Fisherman, but it was a movie. It was a movie about.
We're out of
Peter.
Time. We'll have to pick it up on a future show. But I want to do this because I want to talk about new film technology and whether it makes sense to double or triple frame rates or use this division or whatever it is. We'll talk about that on a future program.
The Big Fisherman.
All right.
Not Big Fish.
Thanks to our critics, Claudia Puig, Andy Klein, and Henry Sheehan. Have a wonderful weekend. I'll be off for the next week and a half. David Lazarus in on Monday.